Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Especially for Easter. So some of you are all excited. You want to do it. Like you're just ready for it. But some of you, this is like, this is your day in church. So let's all get on the same page, right? There's this Easter thing where you say, he is risen. And the response is, he is risen indeed. Okay? So we're going to try it out. I'm going to toss you a soft, he is risen. Let's just see how we do it, all right? He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
Ah, that's so good. You guys are all churchy now. Doesn't matter how you walked in. You are super churchy now. Yeah. Also, this is rare in the church calendar where Easter is actually on April Fool's Day. The red noses, obviously. Which, if you didn't know, it has its roots like probably like 1400s, 1600s, April Fool's Day came about, which I was thinking about this morning. It's a good thing that wasn't around in like first century Jerusalem. Guys, the tomb is empty. It's super messed up, Mary. Too soon, all right? Too soon. Just read a room, Mary. Read the room. Okay, so as we talk about Easter, this is one of the most interesting days for me as a pastor, because for people that are Christians, who identify as Christians, and like, this is a high celebratory day. This is like arguably, outside of Christmas morning, this is like the high point of the Christian calendar. And for others of you, this is a family obligation. Like, you're here because you have to be here. And so we have this mix of people that are so excited. We're celebrating who Jesus is. And there's other people that are just here because they have to be here. And so we want to talk about that. We want to identify that. Because I think leaning into what other people's experience of the thing that either you love or you're indifferent to, it brings out different elements of what this thing is. How many of you, for Christmas or some other holiday in your family, if you have a kind of a larger extended family, did like a name exchange? Like where you like pull names and then you get a gift for this family member. So in my family, in the Kroon family, we did this for Christmas, and we would all meet together on Christmas Eve, and everyone would draw a name and you would open up a gift from that person. And I remember distinctly, I was at that age where like you start figuring out what Christmas is and you are geeked. Like you are so excited. This is gift. This is presents. This is something new that is happening. You're getting something awesome for Christmas. So it's probably like six, seven years old. And when you walk in on name exchange, depending on how your family did, I had no idea who drew my name. I was just excited that I was going to get a gift. And I opened up this gift from my uncle who lived in Montana. Now, Uncle Cornelius. Uncle Corny was a bachelor for years and years and years. He didn't get married until he was in his 40s. But Uncle Corny, imagine him when they're passing out the names. And he gets his six-year-old nephew, who lives in California. He's like, oh, no. I don't hang out with near enough six-year-olds to have any idea what to do with this. So this is in the 1980s. So I got a super sweet 1980s Montana sweatshirt from my uncle in Montana. And when you are a kid, Christmas is for one thing and one thing only. It's toys. This is about toys. There are limited toy options for a sweet wolf sweatshirt that says Montana on it for a kid that lives in California. Like, well, I can rep my Montana cred, but that's not so exciting. And at that point, Christmas Eve turns into something else. It's not just about opening up gifts. If you're 6 or 7 years old, it's a test, and it's called, how excited can you make your face look in front of the whole family when you open up something you're not particularly pumped on? And you can feel the pressure in the room. The pressure in the room is what? Be happy, even if you're not. Say thank you, even if you're like, swing and a miss, Uncle Corny. This isn't exactly what I was looking for, right? Because he bought something for you. You have to say thank you. You have to be grateful for this, even if you don't understand it. Even if you don't know what you're going to do with it. And sometimes that can feel a bit what Easter is. We all come together and we say, Jesus is risen for you. Be excited. Say thank you. And you're like, for what? It's not that I'm not thankful. It's not that I'm not appreciative. Like, Jesus died for me. It's a big deal. Jesus rose again. But I'm supposed to say thank you, and I don't understand what this is for. If you think about the story that we tell and why it's so important to be grateful for the death and resurrection of Jesus, what we are sharing with our kids is, and you put this again through the lens of a child, you have done something, or will do something, or your birth exhibited something that results in eternal damnation. And Jesus just saved you from that. Be grateful. Say thank you. And you're saying, for what? I don't understand it. I don't understand what's going on. It's hard for me to be grateful and to sing songs, and I'm so grateful that Jesus is risen and that I have this thing that's not a part of my life, but I don't understand what it is or how it works. My hope this morning when we look at the story of Jesus is we spend as much time not saying, say thank you, but saying, what is there to be grateful for? What is this act? What did Jesus do? And what is Jesus continuing to do? I think on a certain level, it's a thing that happened that we're supposed to say thank you for forever. But I think on the other hand, it's something that is still happening today. The resurrection, this isn't an observation of something that happened 2,000 years ago. This is a recognition of a reoccurring pattern that's happening over and over and over again. In the face of death, there is new life. In the face of death, there is new life. There is resurrection. And so wherever you're coming at this morning, if this is like your best day and you are so excited, that is amazing. Let's celebrate. Don't be ashamed of your excitement. Be excited. If you're not excited, please don't fake it. Ask questions about why you're not excited. It's okay. Let's talk about it. Let's talk through the process of what this story is and what it could mean to you. So, we're in church. Let's break out some Bibles. We are going to be looking at John 20. We're going to walk through the story of what was happening this day and what do we see revealed to us. So we're going to be looking in John 20, starting in verse 1. If you brought a Bible with you, you can turn there. We read out of the NIV here just because it's one that a lot of people know. It's easy to get, fairly understandable, but there's lots of great translations we encourage you to read. If you didn't bring one, no worries. It will be up here on the screen. John 20, 1 and 2, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both of them were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. So to set the scene, if you're familiar, we have this story, and we've been going through this message series up until this week called Word Made Flesh. We've been looking at this particular story of Jesus that we find in John in the Bible. And if you've been here for some part of it, one of the things that's really been interesting as we've leaned into it is these stories of miracles that Jesus has been doing and his teaching about these miracles is Jesus has been doing some things that are very threatening to the Jewish religious system of the day. And so ultimately, his death, his crucifixion, when you read through the Gospel of John, it actually starts to feel fairly inevitable. It's not a surprise that they kill this man, because he is directly threatening the religious system and the way that they have, the Jews have done the thing. And he's saying, the way that you're holding your understanding of God, you have built a gate around something that has no gate. You've instituted yourself as gatekeeper, and there is no gatekeeper but myself. And so Jesus has pushed pretty hard into the system that no. Who God made us to be, how God is desiring to have relationship with us, you have taken control over a system that is uncontrollable. It's not for you. And by threatening that system, by pushing into us, ultimately he is crucified. Now, the way that the Jewish religious system worked is they had this day of Sabbath. It goes all the way back to the very first story in the Bible of creation. 6 days, God creates everything. And on the seventh day, God rests. So in this day of rest, you do nothing. It's actually, there's quite a tension that gets built up in the death of Jesus, because as Jesus is dying on the cross, it's getting closer and closer to sunset. And how their days worked, it wasn't like midnight and the next day. It was sundown until sunrise. That marked a day. And so as Jesus is getting ready to die, if he dies after sunset, nobody can take him down off the cross because it's the day of Sabbath. And so there's this moment where Jesus dies just before Sabbath, just before sunset, when they can't do any work. So they quickly take him off the cross. They don't have time to prepare his body for burial. They wrap him in linen and they put him in the tomb. They roll the stone in front of it. And now they have to sit and wait. Sundown, sunrise, sundown the next day. This is sunrise on the third day. That's how it's marked. This isn't 72 hours. It's not the way that the days are marked. Sunrise on the first day of the week. Now, and Mary is going to prepare the body of Jesus for burial, to do the things that they couldn't have done the day before. And when she gets there, and the stone is rolled away, if you're unfamiliar, these were huge stones that they would drop into these little gullies, so it would hold the stone in place. Big, heavy stone. And over the tombs, one, to keep in the smell, to separate people from the dead, but also they would sometimes put valuables in there to keep people that would want to rob or steal from the tombs. So to go there and to see the stone rolled away, this would have required the actions of many strong individuals to move it out of the way. Mary is the first to see. And this is important because if you've been walking through the story, Mary serves as a figure. If the disciples are the character that consistently don't understand what Jesus is doing and where he is going, Mary is one of the few characters that gets it, observes Jesus for who he is, and she is the first one to see and to usher in this whole story. Now, what I love is that there's debate. Right, you see this story, and we have Simon Peter, one of the disciples, and the other disciple, the unnamed disciple. But how do we know this disciple? What's the marking? The one Jesus loved, which is awesome. It's a beautiful kind of title. It's likely not meant like exclusively, like Jesus hung out with, 11 jerks and this one guy he was really fond of. But this disciple, the primary identity they felt of themselves after being with Jesus is, I was the one Jesus loved. Now, it's likely that this is John. That John, as he is telling his disciples and they're recording this down, or he is writing, he is identifying himself as, I was the one that felt so deeply loved by Jesus. And I love that as this whole story, this is building to this moment, the death and resurrection of Jesus is the high point of the story. In all Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have different stories that move kind of quickly for the first 3 years of Jesus' ministry. This last week of Jesus' life, from the triumphal entry until his death and resurrection, take up the most scripture of the Gospels by far. It's the culminating high point of the story. And as John is writing the moment that this all becomes revealed, he's like, I don't know if people know how fast I am. I'm pretty quick. So when Mary came and revealed to us, we started running. I gave Simon Peter like a solid 10-yard head start, overtook him. And then people might forget that I got there first, so I'm just going to slide that into the story a couple more times. The one who got there first. I went in second, even though I got there first. We all know that was me. I love that description, that there is still this part where he is bringing in this true-to-life moment and experience. That as he was there being overtook by this, I want to see what is happening. Now, for us who are wearing our pastels, some of us, we're wearing our Easter best. We're here because, like, Jesus is risen. We hear this and we're like, well, yeah, okay. But for them, this story stops here, pauses here in total unknown. What's going on? Did someone steal his body? Was it not enough that they wrongly convicted, beat, and crucified him? Now we're going to steal his body. Now we're going to do something else with him. And for the disciples, who, again, their leader and teacher was just killed, they all go into hiding at this point. There's probably even some deep fear that people are going to assume this is us, that we stole his body. If we weren't in trouble before, we're certainly going to be in trouble now. To think of all this kind of flood of emotions that come into it. We had John Sampson, who I was looking for. Yeah, there's John. John read for us the story of Mary going back and seeing. I want to hit on one part there. This is John 20, 15 through 18. You don't have it? That's okay. Actually, it's not okay. This is one of my worst nightmares. I always read the scripture off the screen, so we're having the same experience together. And okay. We got it. We might have it all the way pop in, or we might need to do a little bit. Okay. That's good news, everybody. So how are you? Everyone doing good? Have a good Easter? Oh, cool. Me too. Let's just talk through it. Mary Magdalene goes back. And she goes and she's having this experience where she's saying, where did you put him? She encounters a man that she thinks the gardener. Think about that for a second. Jesus resurrected. It's not like, oh, well, clearly this is Jesus. There was something about him where she didn't even know that it was Jesus. And she's pleading with him. Look, if you did this, I'm not even upset that you did it. Just tell me where Jesus' body is. Let me prepare him for his burial. Let me prepare him for that. And I love the moment where this man that she thinks is the gardener says, Mary. Just her name. And all of a sudden, the thing that she can't see, the lights come on. And she says, Rabboni, teacher, Jesus, clearly this is you. And Jesus says, hey, don't hold on to me. I haven't gone up to see God yet. I'm going to see my Father, but I will return to you. And so we see this is the moment where, again, Mary's the first to see it. She's first to see the empty tomb, and now she's the first one to observe that Jesus is, in fact, risen. We know where Jesus was. The mystery is over, and she's the one that, again, comes back and is the teacher and the leader to the disciples. This is where Jesus is. This is what has happened. This is what is revealed. The last thing we want to look at is at the very close of John 20, 30 and 31. It talks about the whole purpose. This is what was happening. This is what was going on. This is why the resurrection had to happen. And the language they use there is they say that we can see through this that Jesus is the Messiah. He is God. He is the Son of God. These identities about God for his followers have become clear. This thing that was murky, this thing that they didn't get, now comes into sharp focus. This is who Jesus is. So, if we go back to the question, what is Easter Sunday? What is the resurrection? For people that have grown up in Christianity, people that have become new to Christianity, people that aren't Christians at all, what does this mean? I think our answer into what this day comes to represent and what it is found in these different stories. There's three different identifications that we see pulled out of who Jesus is, what the people around him call him and what he calls himself. The three that we want to talk about is teacher. This is the name that Mary puts on him. When Jesus says Mary and he says Rabboni, that is teacher. So the question is, this idea of, well, Jesus is our teacher. It's when Jesus says, this is why I came, this is why the resurrection happened, so you would know I am the Messiah. We want to say that the Messiah is a term that for the Jewish people, the belief that one day they were going to have a leader come to return the Jewish nation, God's chosen people, to prominence. And for many of them, as we talked about many times, because the belief about the Messiah is that he would come from the line of David, is that this would be a king. This would be a ruler. And the role of the kings all throughout Jewish history was to come bring them back to prominence, usually through power of military, to be the dominant power of that area and of that day. So the belief is that when Jesus is saying, I am the Messiah, it's actually this really sly call to, no, that military king that you were looking for, that was Jesus. This ruler, the one that you put your hopes and your future in, that was Jesus. So what do we learn about the way that Jesus takes on this title Messiah? And finally, the identification that we have most strongly in the Gospel of John. We talked before, there's this time where Jesus is before the teachers and the Pharisees, the religious rulers, and they ask him about who he is and his identity. And he says, I am, which is referenced back to when Moses is at the burning bush and God is sending Moses to set the Israelite people free from Egypt. And Moses is like, I'm not going to stand on my own two feet. Who should I say sent me? And God says, my identification, the God of the universe, is known simply as I am. Beautiful, powerful. The only entity that could ever hold that name, I am. And Jesus says, I am. They pick up rocks to kill him. This is blasphemy. This is heresy. So Jesus has made this claim before, and in his resurrection, he's saying this should become even sharper, even clearer. I am. So what do we learn from these three identifications that Jesus has? What could it mean to us? The first, as teacher, what was Jesus teaching us? I think through his life, what Jesus is teaching us is how to live. What does it look like to live? What does it look like to be? You all have, you're alive. You're here. So you have difficulty. You have struggles. Some days it's great. Today might be a sugar-infused just daydream, just the best. And tomorrow there might be a sugar crash. Or there might be the realities of the work week come back. There are good days and there are bad days, and there's everything else in between. Isn't there something powerful about learning? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to be? Because in teaching how to live, it is an invitation to say there is something more than survival. There's something more than just keep going, to be alive another day. No, there's something in how to live, on how to engage life and draw so much more from it than simply passing by. And I don't know about you, but I feel this sharply. It might just be my own personal. I feel like most of my life is spent avoiding my life. Most of my days is spent avoiding my days. And most of my time is like, all right, how do we just get to bedtime? I have two young boys, so like that's a thing. And not my own bedtime, although that is a big bonus. How do we just get to bedtime? And I hit that like as a finish line, not a starting block. And then it's just winding down the day and going to bed, and then we kick it all back on the next day. And it's like I just have this thing and this thing and this thing. Oh, how to live? That could change everything. This is what we see in Jesus' identification as teacher, Messiah. Messiah is about king. It's about returning to prominence. It's about leading the Israelite people back to their prominent role as God's chosen people. What we learn from the Messiah is how do we overcome? What does it look like to overcome? What does it look like to feel victory? How do we receive this kind of victory? Maybe some of you are just killing it, like every day. It's like, man, I am locking up mom of the year, dad of the year, employee of the year, friend of the year. I'm pretty much rocking every identification of being great every day. I just pull up my checklist, click it, and say, nailed it once again. Or maybe the end of the day is like, blew that thing, missed that thing, didn't do it. An idea of victory feels a million miles away. So what would it look like to understand some kind of victory or overcoming? The last one of God. Jesus is God. What do we learn from God in the flesh, God living and working among us, might be how do we see? The God who created everything, who makes it all, who makes us, and this is the idea that constantly kind of chases me and is the animating force in my life, but my understanding of God. God knows me better than I know myself. I don't know about you. I constantly feel like a stranger to myself. Why did I do that? I am too darn old to be asking those questions. I should have some idea of why I do what I do. So returning to God plugs me back into the source of, oh, this is who I am. This is why I move and I work. This is the why I respond in these ways. It's not something that I found that I just get by sinking further into myself, but by understanding more about the God who made me, I can see, sometimes for the first time, myself and others. Understanding that there's a God who made us all also helps me see other people, not just myself as someone who is loved and has value and has an ability to move and work in the way that is helpful and provides flourishing for myself and others, but it helps me see other people not just as obstacles to my own checklist and things I want to do, but as a part of this big, beautiful world that we live in. To understand Jesus as God is to see sometimes for the first time. Now, this happened to work really well. If you just go back in the Gospel of John, there's scriptures that draw out and pull out these aspects of what Jesus came to teach us, how Jesus came to lead us as Messiah to overcome, and what he called us to see as God. The first I want to look at is what did he come to teach us is in John 13. John 13, 34 and 35, a new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. One thing that's really true of all writing, but certainly in this time in the Greek and in the way of the Jewish mindset and mentality, the repeated words are the point. We say it multiple times so you get it. The dominant word is, what did Jesus come to teach us? It's how to love. Think of your own relationship with love throughout your life. Again, for me, it's been a messy one. Who I've thought has loved me and who I thought I loved has been hard, difficult. Talk about love lost or love broken. One thing that was really true, and I experienced a lot in my adolescence, if you go to any high school, this concept of love is usually a one-sided conversation. Not all the time, but a lot of times it's like, this is who I love, or this is who loves me. But it's not this reciprocal moving back and forth thing. That's too much information to take in. I love this person. Is that enough? Or does love by its very virtue require two people? Does it require to learn, to sit with, to see another person? I love that Jesus calls this a new command. I clearly don't think you've been picking this one up. In all the different ways we've tried to lean into this, why are we trying to teach this? All right, new commandment, love one another. Jesus says in the other gospels, all of the law, everything we've ever given you as God's chosen people to share about yourself and to see in the world can be boiled down to this. Love one another as you love yourself and love God. Love God, love others. And if you're like, I've heard that before, easy. Is it? It still seems like a precious, rare commodity in our world. We're really good at being right in our world today. We're really good about determining who's on the right side of things and who's on the wrong side of things. We're really good at determining who we should listen to and who is not worth listening to anymore. We're really good at deciding, like, these people are okay and these people are trash, but love seems hard to come by. It's rare. Jesus was teaching us, this is how you love. And how do we love? We follow the example of Jesus. Jesus Christ, spoiler alert, we're going to get this again in three, is God. So the God put on human flesh has the ability to do whatever God would want in the world. It's the very nature of being God. What did Jesus do with that unspeakable power? How many times did Jesus capitalize on the power that he had for his own sake or benefit? Not one time. So Jesus took the power that he had, unspeakable, limitless power, and used it to love and serve other people, which was primarily to see them first and engage with them. There are times when Jesus, who had all power and all ability, would ask, do you want to be healed? Do you want to see? Do you want to walk? I don't think Jesus was asking rhetorical questions. I think he was inviting the other people to be a part of their own healing. Come participate, because this is the way of love. We actually see and engage other people for who they are, not our agenda for them. This is the example of God. God does not, Easter is not a celebration of the loss of your autonomy and freedom to reject that love or invitation. No. It's an invitation, and because this is what love is, and this is the very nature of God, it will always remain an invitation. It's not forced. It's not power, and I'm going to give you what's good for you, whether or not you think it is or not. That's not love. So two things that we learn from this and how God calls us to love. One, you hold unspeakable power. You may not have ever thought of that. You may not have ever been told that. You hold unspeakable power in who you are, because the God of the universe created you, and God put his own image within you. I don't care if other people have seen it or called it into being. You hold unspeakable power to bless and love all the world. To love all the world. To love the people around you. And sometimes the way that we talk about it in our own twisted reality is that love is the tool of the weak. That's what you do if you can't beat or overpower people, is you better love them. Because life is ultimately about getting what you want. That is the exact opposite of the invitation and teaching of Jesus Christ and of God. You have unspeakable power, and it is the ability to love others, to see others. Because as we all see and love one another well, there is a rising of all ships. There's a movement of all ships to both give and receive this love. Every person you've ever met, you have something to offer them, and they have something to offer you. Age, ability, gender, doesn't matter. It's not like some of you have something to offer those that are younger than you and you should go do it. No. Every person you've ever met, made in the image of God, has something to offer you, and you have something to offer them. This is the beautiful reality of God's power and love in us. Two, Jesus is Messiah. He taught us how to overcome. Ooh, who could get some winning today, huh? I want to win. I want victory. I want to have like that good things. And this is like sometimes in churches, we get that power, like who wants that victory? Who wants the winning, huh? Yes, we want like the good stuff. I want to see my bank account rise. I'm going to be on top because that's what God has for me. Jesus came as Messiah, took the name of Messiah. What was Jesus Christ's great military plan and coup? To submit himself to death by the Roman authorities. He was invited over and over and over again to lead the greatest military campaign of all time. You think he couldn't have defeated the Romans? He brought Lazarus back to life. He was dead for 4 days. What power did Jesus not have? What ability did Jesus not have to overcome? He took on the name and mantle of overcoming because he was telling us how we overcome. The path of violence, the path of power used against each other always leads to death. Always leads to death. We get nowhere walking this journey. You truly want to follow the Messiah? You want power? You want to overcome? Follow me to death, to oneself, to death, to our dreams, our ideas, our hopes of what they would. Not so that they're dashed, not so that your agency is removed and we see that what you think never mattered, but no, we see those things die so that they can be resurrected back to life even better than we could have hoped. Jesus brings to us every hope and dream we ever had for our life and our reality, not the way we thought it would happen. Not through victory, not through power, not through overwhelming other people. Isn't that amazing? Easter Sunday should be celebrated by every individual in the world, if nothing because it is a tale of victory through death. An end to this ridiculous cycle of violence we continue to find ourselves in. More death and more violence. That's how we win. No, no, no. You think that wasn't available to Jesus? Then what, Jesus, are you worshiping? Especially for Christians. Christians, we should know better. And Christians should be at the forefront of repenting for every crusade that was ever led. It is a direct slap in the face of Jesus Christ who died for us. If he wanted a crusade, he would have led it. He took us somewhere else. The last one, Jesus is God. What did he come to help us see? Let's look here in John 9. This is after Jesus healed the blind man. For judgment I have come into this world so that the blind will see and those who see will become blind. Whew. That's some crazy doublespeak. What is Jesus saying? Jesus came as God. He comes to help us see ourselves and one another. How? Why? What does that look like? Jesus is inviting us that those who have been blind, those who have been told they lack something, the mark of blindness in our culture and world is you have something that most of the rest of us have, you don't have it, and therefore you are lacking and you don't have it. What Jesus is saying is, no, go there. They have something you actually can't see. They have something of incredible value that you don't value, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have unspeakable value. Are you with me? There's something so significant to this way, and the way that our country has worked and the way that we believe is this concept in the West of manifest destiny, that these parts of the world belong to us. We will take them by power and by overcoming is because we have the thing that is valuable and we will wipe you out so we can lift that valuable thing up high. Isn't it possible we wiped something out of incredible value? A way of seeing life? A way of seeing the world, a way of engaging it, a way of peace? Who do you think is blind? Who do you think, man, they just don't get it? Is it possible they just see something you can't see? And is it possible that that's the invitation from God? And when God put on flesh, he said, these people you have no value for have unspeakable value. You don't go hang out with them because you have something to offer them. You go hang out with them because you have something to learn from them. Who don't you see? Who don't you value? Because we have a list. There's people of different abilities. There are people of different ages. There's people of different genders, different walks of life, and parts of the world they're from that we think they probably don't have something to offer us. And we wouldn't say it in polite company, but we would think it. What if the invitation of Jesus, God in this world, is like, oh, no, I created them. They're here for you to see. You're not sent to heal their blindness. You're sent to have your blindness healed. How do we see ourselves and how do we see this world? Jesus came. The reason why we celebrate Easter is through the death and resurrection of Jesus. We see, and for the first time, our teacher, our Messiah, and our God. Easter is an invitation to life, not an IOU. Easter isn't a promise that someday life will be available to you when you breathe your last and you go and you die. That is a promise far too weak for the power of God. The resurrection is an invitation to life here, now, this moment, today. It's right here. It's for us to engage and see right now. The celebration of Easter is that there is life to be lived today during brunch. There is life for the day after Easter. And there is life anew every single day. We don't wait for heaven. It's not a future reality, a world that God orders and calls into being. We are invited to participate in today, here and now. And there is far too much hell in our world for us not to accept that invitation. Why do we have to be worried about a future hell? Have you watched the news? There's no future hell to fear as much as the hell that is here and now. And the invitation to life in heaven is just as palpable and just as clear. It's an invitation. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. I hope that for Easter, you can see the deep value of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and it causes you to say, thank you. But more than that, I hope Easter causes you to say yes. I hope that it causes you to accept the invitation to this world here and now to see that Jesus as our Messiah, Jesus as our teacher, Jesus as our God is worth following and throwing our whole life into today, here and now, because it's too important for us and the whole world. Let's pray. Jesus, your life, your death, your resurrection changes everything. Jesus, it is a million miles away from a sweatshirt from Montana that we're forced to say thank you from. God, it's an invitation that leads to an eternity of thank yous for the way that it helps restore and set right our hearts and our souls in the midst of ourselves and our world. God, may we listen to your teaching and love others. May we follow your leadership as our Messiah and bring peace. And God, may we see you as God that causes us to see ourselves and others. God, that we are put on this planet together for the flourishing redemption of all. Jesus, move us into action here and now and today. It's in your name we pray. Amen.